Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A new player has emerged and plans to remake the former GM Boxwood Road plant and could ultimately change what happens there.
The language attached to this announcement is that they say it's going to, quote, dramatically accelerate the process of the development of the site.
Contributor John Hurdle has more on what's next for the old auto plant in Newport. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also have a preview of the holiday shopping season, including some new, somewhat surprising trends. Our arts playlist tells us about a new mural celebrating the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware. And Enlighten Me focuses on a new effort to better preserve the Jewish community's history in the first state. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The much-anticipated plans to remake the former GM Boxwood Road plant in Newport into a giant logistics center may be accelerating. A new player has emerged in the process, taking on a significant piece of the 142-acre site earlier this month. Who is this new player, and what can we divine from their entry into this project? Those are questions contributor John Hurdle tackles in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to share what he found. Let's start with the basics. Who's jumping into this project now, and what do we know about them?
Who's jumping into this is Dermody Properties. Now, Dermody Properties is a Reno, Nevada-based company which specializes in the development of logistics properties across the country. They've been going for almost 60 years, and they are known for working with a large number of Fortune 500 companies, Walmart, Xerox, UPS. There's a big laundry list full of their clients, Harvey Hanna, the Delaware company that began the development of the Boxwood Road site, of course, is highly complimentary of their new partners.
What do we know about the plans that they have for the site, and how they would differ from what Harvey Hanna had initially had in mind for the Boxwood Road plant area?
Well, the new plan is quite a bit bigger. What they want to build, what they propose, is a total of 3.8 million square feet in one single building, in one single warehouse, as opposed to about 3 million square feet across four buildings. This is seen as being a significant increase in the economic activity on the site, whoever that tenant turns out to be.
And just to kind of clarify for people, this new group has bought kind of the majority of the property, and Harvey Hanna just has a smaller piece now that it will work with.
That's right. Yes, I think it's around about two-thirds of the 142-acre property which has been purchased by the new developer.
And you note in your piece that this change comes with a promise that things are going to move faster at the site. Are there any specifics tied to that promise of a quicker move on developing this property?
Unfortunately, no specifics. They haven't given us any timeline, but the language attached to this announcement is that they say it's going to, quote, dramatically accelerate the process of the development of the site. And we should say also that when it was purely Harvey Hanna that was going to develop the site, they were talking about completion of their whole project in 9 years. So we're led to believe that the development is going to be a whole lot quicker than that now that the other developer is involved.
With that in mind, where do things stand with the site right now? How ready is it to actually do anything?
Well, the demolition of the former GM buildings started about a year ago. The companies say that the demolition is now nearly done, and then plans call for a phased construction. There will be improvements in terms of traffic flow and pedestrian facilities, and there'll be some green space.
Now, you mentioned earlier that some of the larger companies that this new player is involved with, are Walmart, UPS, Xerox. Certainly, these changes have prompted speculation that another big player, Amazon, might be a possible candidate to become tenant for this one big warehouse that they're talking about building. Is there anything out there that backs that speculation up?
Well, I think the speculation is based on two things. One is that the new plan is for a single warehouse as opposed to four buildings, which was previously proposed. And also, this is a very large site. Clearly, Amazon is known for taking very large facilities, and so that has stoked the speculation. But it has to be said that it is just speculation. I attempted to get some comment out of Amazon, but I was unable to. I didn't get a response. So that's where it stands.
And refresh your memories, why would this site be an attractive one for an Amazon or any other large logistics operation?
Well, it's got to do with the site's location at the heart of the very populous northeast market. It's also just a couple of miles from I-95. It has rail facilities. And there will be a rail link to the Port of Wilmington, which of course is in the process of expansion and modernization. And of course, it's a very large site. So all of those things put together make it a very attractive proposition for anybody who is in the logistics and distribution business.
So if this plan does come to fruition as planned, what kind of economic impact might be anticipated for the northern part of Delaware?
Well, according to one study that was done by the consultant eConsult in 2018, they were predicting that the project as planned then would create 2,100 permanent jobs. Of course, that was before the new developer got involved. And I was chatting with one economics professor from the University of Delaware a couple of days ago, and he was speculating that a single tenant on the site would be maybe in a better position to able to create more jobs than a number of tenants would. And so there's the optimism out there is that the economic impact is actually going to be greater than estimated greater than estimated last year.
But certainly this wouldn't be like the return of an auto plant such as the ill-fated Fisker auto plant that was at one point targeted for this site, or perhaps another manufacturer. Maybe in some ways this winds up just being the best possible outcome for the site rather than maybe a return to its heyday.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, we should note that Harvey Hanna, when they were in this on their own, they tried to attract manufacturers to the site. That was plan A, if you will. But they found after about a year of marketing the site to the manufacturing community that it was kind of obsolete, that there was that these 1940s era buildings just were unsuitable to modern manufacturing demands, and so with the demolition of this historic site, so now finally manufacturing is off the table. And what we have now is a site that's particularly suitable for logistics and distribution and e-commerce fulfillment, which of course is much more suited to the modern economy.
And certainly those jobs though are not quite as high paying as the ones that would come maybe with a manufacturing site as opposed to a logistics site. That may, while there may be a fair number of jobs, they may not be the type of jobs that were there before.
Well, indeed, and everybody accepts that that logistics jobs aren't as well paid as the jobs that were on the site before. But I think that if you speak with local folks who spent many years working in the plant, as I've done during earlier iterations of this story, people welcome the fact that after about a decade of this site lying dormant, that there is now a good prospect that there's going to be a going concern in that location.
Thanks to contributor John Hurrell for his time on The Green this week. His piece on what's next for the former GM Boxwood Road plant in Newport is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We take a look at how this year's holiday shopping season is shaping up. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This week's frigid temps and the avalanche of emails you may be receiving about pre-Black Friday deals are a sure indication that even with Thanksgiving still 2 weeks away, the holiday shopping season is here. So how does this year's season shape up for retailers and consumers? Each year we turn to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for answers. Her reporting on this year's expectations and trends is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to talk about what she learned. Let's start with the outlook. How busy are retailers expecting to be this year? Is this going to be another big season for them?
It's looking like it's going to be a very good season for them. And one estimate has shopping dollars topping $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, for the very first time.
So why is this outlook so bullish again this year? I mean, I know that we talked even earlier this year, you know, when we talked about tariffs and things like that, that maybe there was more uncertainty for this holiday shopping season. Why has that seemed to have dissipated and things look good again?
Well, there's a direct correlation to consumer confidence. We're seeing wages rising for the first time in a long time. And also the whole tariff troubles didn't materialize for this season because merchants were feeling so confident that they stocked up before the tariffs went into effect.
One other possible factor this year would be the date. This year, Thanksgiving is later than usual. Does a truncated shopping season make a difference, particularly considering that retailers, let's be honest, are already putting out some of their deals? You know, if you look at your email inbox, they're already there. Does the timing at all make a difference?
I think so. It's a very short season, only 26 days. It's the shortest that it can possibly be. And that is why everybody is starting early and trying to entice shoppers to the store. I think we're going to see a real crunch, some very heavy Black Friday traffic, even more people shopping on Thanksgiving when we wake up and say, wow, it's only 26 days until Christmas.
So we've spent a lot of time in recent years talking about brick and mortar sales versus online sales. But I was fascinated this year, you've identified some other trends to look at, one of which is what people are focusing on. And your story says the emphasis seems to be shifting away perhaps from, you know, getting the latest cool stuff, right?
It is. It's more spa treatments and less sweaters. It's more experiences and less tangible things that you can hold in your hand. More gifts are focusing on travel and dining out and experiences. I spoke with a professor at the University of Delaware who bought snowboarding lessons for her son. So I think that this goes hand in hand with an overall trend towards decluttering, that people are saying, you know, I have a lot of stuff. I think I would rather spend time with my loved ones or do something that I really enjoy as an individual.
It is a fascinating trend. But people still look for stuff, right? And when they do, you're also noting that perhaps they're trying to find things that are a little bit more unique and maybe atypical than something you just buy at a regular department store or a big box store.
Yeah, I think that we're looking for things that are handmade, things that have some sort of real ambiance to them. The Poplar Hall Christmas market in Newark last year attracted so many people that they had to just move it to a bigger venue. So this year it's going to be in Chesapeake City. Also, the Delaware Center for Horticulture is offering its first holiday bazaar. And so when you buy wreaths and things like that, they're going to be from locally sourced plants, different kinds of crafts that are made by hand. And we want to support our local merchants and the people in our own communities.
So you also note that, that there's a role for demographics in what we're looking at trend-wise and in shoppers' habits. Can you explain that, how things are kind of breaking down now demographically?
Oh, it's so interesting because we look at members of Generation Z. They're ages 18 to 22, and they grew up with a smartphone in their hand. They don't know about life before the internet, but they are going to be doing their shopping in brick and mortar stores, partly because they're social and they like to hang out with their friends, but also because they're young and they don't have credit cards that you need to have if you're going to buy things online.
Fascinating.
But then the millennials, ages 23 to 38, they do have their credit cards, and they will do most of their shopping online, and they're looking to buy electronics. They also are most likely to shop at dollar stores. The baby boomers, who are ages 55 to 73, are the most likely to go to department stores. You'll find them at Macy's. And they're also the most likely to buy gifts of wine and liquor, which I found very interesting. And then the members of the silent generation, ages 74 to 91, are the procrastinators, which really surprised me. So they're just, going to wait until it's close to Christmas. About half of them will shop online, and then a lot of them will just write checks.
Fascinating. I guess what I see there is there really is a spread. And so, you do see room for the online shopping, room for the brick and mortar shopping, the room for the early bird and the procrastinator. I mean, retailers really do have to address that whole spectrum of consumer.
They really do. And the thing that really sort of tickled me is that someone who is 90 is as likely to shop online as someone who is 18 and doesn't have a credit card.
That's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Are there some other trends that we're seeing as we head into this holiday shopping season?
Well, one thing that we're seeing that has been a constant is that price is the number one factor that consumers are looking for. And I think that is probably contributing toward this very disconcerting trend of shoppers returning things. You see something online, you like it, you order it, then you see something you like better, and because it frequently doesn't cost anything to return it, they're sending it back. So this is, we're seeing even before Christmas an extraordinary number of returns. It's up about 26% over last year.
Wow, that's interesting because, we've always kind of looked at it as like, well, it's after Christmas when all the returns are. I'm sure there still are, but people are actually, kind of swapping things out even before they get to giving the gifts out.
Yes. If they find it for less, or they find it in a different color, or learn that the person they were buying for really wants something else, they're just sending it back.
And they have the flexibility to do so. Despite all these changes we've talked about, shopping on Thanksgiving and Black Friday, still a thing. So what kind of deals are out there if people are going to brave the madness of Thanksgiving and Black Friday?
Good gravy, Tom. The deals are incredible. And this is on both Thanksgiving Day and on Black Friday, the trend towards people shopping on Thanksgiving, there has been some backlash, and a lot of really big name retailers aren't going to be open on Thanksgiving, like Costco and Nordstrom and Apple. And But more people are going to be shopping on Thanksgiving. 58% of people will be gobbling up those bargains on Thanksgiving Day, and that's up from 45% last year, a significant increase.
Yeah.
So they're going to find things like Best Buy has incredible, incredible deals, a really great Nikon camera with a two-lens kit that's typically $1,200 is going to be $700. Target, the Instant Pot continues to be a strong trend in small appliance land, and they're going to be selling them for $65.
Wow.
Marked down from $100. Walmart has some super bargains. A 10.5-inch Apple iPad for $699. That's marked down $300. Kohl's, consumers really seem to be attracted to Kohl's Cash, in which you get this paper money or on your phone money that you can apply to other purchases. So you can get a Fitbit 3 for $99, and that's reduced $50, and you'll also get $30 in Kohl's Cash.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. A reminder, her piece on the holiday shopping season is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And there's more to come on The Green, including our latest arts playlist, which brings us more on a new mural focused on the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware. That's up next, after a check of your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. November is Native American Heritage Month. To celebrate, Cheney University professor and painter Marietta D'Antonio Madsen, with help from 10 of her students and some volunteers, created a mural depicting the story of the Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware, past, present, and future. D'Antonio Madsen says the 10-foot by 6-foot mural was a very labor-intensive project and required extensive research. The Lenape community in Cheswold assisted with the research and weighed in on what it wanted included in the piece. For this edition of Arts Playlist, D'Antonio Madsen spoke to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele shortly after a November 1st opening reception for the mural at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover.
Let's talk about the mural. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I am in a doctoral program at Wilmington University, and I needed to work with a group that did not know me and I haven't worked with previously to do my research for my dissertation. I've done about 100 healing arts projects around the community and globally, and many with Indigenous peoples. So to find a group locally that I have not worked with was a bit of a challenge. And one of my classmates, Christina, suggested that I connect with the Lenape Tribe of Delaware. So that was how that started. And I met with Melody Klein and spoke with her and asked if I could meet with their tribal leaders to get permission to create a mural of the history of their people. And I was so delighted. I was graciously welcomed by the elders and the Lenape community. And I gave them the parameters of what I wanted them to do so that I could do this project with them.
How much research actually went into this project?
There was a lot of research. The beauty of working with the Lenape, they have put a lot of effort into their ancestry research and documentation, and they had all that information there. And having the information that are the facts and really made this project run smoother. They even have the names of the original families of the Lenape in the Chesbald area, which was fantastic.
You seem well-versed on the Lenape tribe. Give us some of their background.
The Lenape have always been in Delaware. They are the tribe, part of the tribe that did not migrate to other areas of America. And the beauty of this mural is that many of them did not know their ancestry. I interviewed seven people who worked on the project, and when they were growing up, they were not really told the stories of their people and the ancestry. So this mural is not only going to benefit the local community, the local Lenape, but it will be a story that will be told and retold, hopefully for the next seven generations of people.
All right. I want to remind everyone we're talking to Marietta D'Antonio Mattson. She's an associate professor at Cheney University, just in time for Native American Heritage Month this month. D'Antonio Mattson and her students have created a mural depicting the story of the Lenape Indian tribe of Delaware. The large artwork went on display at the beginning of the month, November 1st, at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover, downtown Dover. Biggs Museum is such a great place, and what a better, there couldn't be a better place, in my opinion, for a mural like this. Talk to me about the parameters of the mural. How big, how long, how tall, who did most of the artwork?
I agree with you that the Biggs Museum is the perfect location because it is American art, and for them to embrace the local Lenape community is a gift to not only the Biggs Museum, but of course to all the people of the community. The mural is broken down into six panels for ease of transportation. My husband went shopping with me, and we picked the best wood that we could find for longevity. And he cut the panels first into three panels, and then the weight of it would be too difficult for people to transport if it went on tour, because that was our hope. So we were asked to cut them in half again, which we did, or my husband did, I didn't. And so each panel, when it's put together, is 6 feet tall, so each one is of the six or 3 feet. And then when you put them together, it's about 9 feet long.
How many Cheney students have some Native American background? Is it a large amount?
That's a great question. It's surprising how many students, when asked, will tell us that they have Cherokee, they have Blackfoot. They're the two main ones that I have heard students tell me. And you don't know that unless you're working on a project such as this. And I've done other projects with other Native tribes. In fact, we worked with the United Nations years ago and for the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. And many of the students that went with me were also had Native American blood in them. So I don't think a study has been done, but that's a good point. It would be good to research that. Thank you.
I think people should be proud of their ancestry. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, yes, totally.
All right, let's talk, go back to the mural again. I know this is radio, so this is going to be hard, but people viewing the mural, some of the scenes, tell us about some of the scenes on the that have been painted on the mural.
Well, on the left side of the mural, there is a ship, a tall ship, resembling the Kalmar Nickel, which is the colonization symbol where it approached tribal land in Delaware. Also on the left side, we see a beautiful peach tree that was painted. And please note that all of the symbols used were symbols of ideas and imagery that the Lenape tribe collectively agreed on and asked us to please make sure they were on the mural. So that alone was an organizational joy for me and also something that I took very seriously. So the peach tree was something that was part of their commercial trade during the 19th century, and they wanted that depicted. We see a wigwam, which is an original shelter of the Lenape, some revered birds, which would be an eagle, a turkey, a hawk, and then spirits of the deer and the turkey, because their hides were sacred and used for clothing, nourishment. The Unami clan, which is the turkey, it's the totem of one of the totems of the Lenape people and the Lenape of Delaware. It is their totem. You see spiritual ceremonies. Actually, the ceremonies, the dancing, and clothing is in the past, present, and future. The panels depict all three. So you see how ceremonies would have been conducted in the past, and then in the present, and then in the future.
This sounds so exciting. I can't wait to see this. Now, talk to me. I understand that you plan to help the Lenape get prints made of the mural. Talk to me about this.
Yes. It really would not be that difficult for them to photograph the mural and then have prints made, and they could be signed by the chief and elders, and I can sign it, and then the sales from the prints would be used to go into a fund to help them, because their ultimate goal is to have a cultural center on their original land that belongs to them.
What else about the mural do you want the general public to know about?
I think what fascinated me was how spiritual every single part of the experience was. There's storytelling about culture and community and collaboration, yet from the very beginning of the stories, there's that spiritual connection in everything that they do. And the recognition that the Lenape are still here, they're still in Delaware, they haven't gone anywhere. And, you know, many people say, oh, there's, you know, no Indians around, but it's not true. You know, the truth is that not all people left, and there are people, Lenape Indians, still on Delaware land, their original land, which is so beautiful.
All right. The Lenape Tribe of Delaware Healing Arts mural is on exhibit right now at the Biggs Museum. The Biggs, located on Federal Street in downtown Dover. It went on view on November 1st. How long will the mural be on display?
The mural is expected to be there through January. In fact, January 18th, Chief Dennis Coker and I will be giving a lecture at the museum about the mural, and we're hoping to have a good group of people come at that time as well. It's absolutely beautiful, and the Biggs Museum did a fabulous job displaying quotes from the Lenape all on the walls, and then a little bit of the story of the mural. And then the mural is highlighted with lighting and on a pedestal in the middle in a big room, and it's just so beautiful.
Thanks to Cheney University professor Marietta D'Antonio Madsen and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. The Lenape Indian Tribe of Delaware mural is currently on display at the Biggs Museum through January 2020. And The Green wraps up next with Enlighten Me, and a look at a new effort by the Delaware Historical Society to create a home for the Jewish Historical Society of Delaware. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The Delaware Historical Society is embarking on a new effort to help preserve another part of First State history and make it more available to researchers and the public. The Jewish Historical Society of Delaware was founded in 1974, and since then has worked to acquire, preserve, and publish material pertaining to the history of Jewish settlement and Jewish life in Delaware. But it hasn't had a truly functional physical home, so it's teaming up with the Delaware Historical Society to raise money to transform one of the Historical Society's buildings on Willingtown Square in Wilmington into a space that can properly store important objects and archival material and make them accessible to those who need them. That building is the Cox House, and the campaign for the Cox House was launched this month to start raising the necessary funds. For this week's Enlighten Me, we chat with the Delaware Historical Society's Executive Director, David Young, about this project.
What was the impetus for this project with the Jewish Historical Society of Delaware and the Cox House?
Well, the Jewish Historical Society was ahead of the game in the early 70s and formed to keep a record of the legacy of the Jewish community in Wilmington as many of the buildings were being torn down to construct government office buildings here in the commercial heart of Wilmington near Market Street. So the Jewish Historical Society of Delaware was to be located at the Delaware Historical Society. And so this was before Roots had, turned a variety of Americans onto genealogy or family records or keeping a legacy of the record of their legacy. This was before the Bicentennial turned many communities, including communities that were not widely preserved and represented in traditional historical societies like ours. So the Jewish community in Delaware, led by people like Tony Young, were a little bit ahead of ethnic communities that in just a few years, because of Roots and the Bicentennial, would have the bug of keeping their community's heritage more remembered. So the Jewish Historical Society has had an over 50-year record of keeping its connections of the Wilmington heritage with the Delaware Historical Society. However, the records have grown so much that it is now a challenge to really provide the public access to the records. So as families or genealogical researchers are coming to look for some of those files, they're hard to come by because they're in a cramped corner of the basement of the library of the Delaware Historical Society. With that in mind, and with attention being paid ever increasingly to the Delaware Historical Society's 9 buildings, we have an empty building on Willingtown Square, the Thomas Cox House, built in 1801. We were thinking, is there a way to partner to solve a couple of problems, the cramped storage of the Delaware Historical Society's research library, the need for a more accessible, publicly accessible program space for the Jewish Historical Society's collections, and activating one of our buildings on Willingtown Square, the Thomas Cox House. So with these discussions, which started before I came here, they started roughly in April of 2018, and I arrived in June of 2018, the seeds have been planted about a win-win-win, activating one of the empty buildings of the Historical Society, more access for people to research the Jewish Historical Society's collections and room to grow them, while also allowing for the expansion of some of the collection storage of the Delaware Historical Society's research library. This win-win-win became the idea of a growing partnership with the Jewish Federation, the Delaware Historical Society, and the new ethic to really preserve many of the buildings that have been adapted and deserve a little bit more attention, especially our 6 library buildings on the campus. And I have a strong preservation background and came into the job with an idea that we could really activate these buildings, preserve them within the heart of a very lively downtown corridor in Wilmington. So the promise almost presented itself because the Cox House has just been sort of sitting there waiting for a reason to be a little bit more active.
Can you give us a little bit more about the history of the Cox House itself? And I guess, what its origins are?
Sure. The Cox House was built by Thomas Cox, who was a bricklayer or a brickmaker, and he built it for his children. And it was really a twin on 107 East 6th Street. And it had been moved to prevent its demolition, along with three other buildings that were relocated to Willingtown Square, what I call a preservation petting zoo. These buildings were preserved by sort of last resort, relocating them to the square. But 107 East 6th Street is really in the proximity of the lively spaces where the Jewish community had established their presence in the commercial life of Wilmington in the late 1800s. And after the Civil War, merchants were finding the opportunity to sell many goods that were now ready-made, like uniforms and clothing. So the Cox House is actually National Register listed. And he built it. Thomas Cox built it for its daughters, and it had been a law office until 2012, and most recently, it had been part of the staffing offices of the Delaware Historical Society. But through the Cox House in the 1850s and 1870s was a private residence, but growing up around it were leading merchants like Lieberman's, Myers, Lazarus, Topkiss, and they were all really not just vibrant commercial leaders in the commercial corridor of Wilmington among the business community. They were also leading civic minded leaders in the life, the growing life of the commercial development of Wilmington into the 1920s, 30s, and 40s.
So, How much do you hope to raise for this project? And I guess what exactly will the renovations of this building entail to make it kind of bring the vision you're talking about alive?
Well, it's a three-story building, and it's it needs to be, it has been assessed structurally with a few modifications. We had to make sure that its relocated status would allow us to store things as heavy as shelves and archival documents and boxes and supplies, and it can. It just needs a couple of modifications for ADA access, for replacing some really old HVAC equipment to give a sound environmental conditions for the old records. And some of these records are founding documents of essential synagogues and faith communities like Adas Kodesh and the charters of important community organizations in the Jewish community. So we have to retrofit an 1801 building to be 21st century sound for collection, storage, and access. It'll also include things like a dumbwaiter for easier access for the staff to get records from the third floor, sprinklers, a new roof. The whole campaign is roughly $400,000, and that will include modernization and disability access, as well as a new roof and other features, video surveillance, motion detectors, and the kinds of things that will allow it the sort of program space that the Jewish Historical Society has been lacking.
I was going to say, it sounds in a lot of ways like you're trying to give the Jewish Historical Society a real physical home. And is there something about that makes a difference? I mean, I've been in Delaware for a long time, and one example I can remember is, for the longest time, the Delaware Sports Hall of Fame didn't have a home until it was able to create a museum down at Frawley Stadium. And now that has something that people can tangibly connect with. Is it the same type of thing here, that you're going to be able to give them something that people can tangibly connect with?
Yes, and it's really important that where there's a historical place like Midtown Market Street, where the Jewish community had a sense of place, to be proximate to where many researchers come for a sense of history, to delve into their family history, genealogy, or see the exhibits and displays and programs of the Delaware Historical Society. So place and proximity give it a sense of presence. And being present, the Cox House being present in the life of the community near DCAD, near where we have the People's Festival, which celebrates the Jamaican immigrant experience, near the Jane and Littleton Mitchell Center for African American Heritage. Now the Jewish Historical Society will have a shingle out where many people celebrate the ethnic heritage of Wilmington and the Delaware experience that includes immigrants, migrants, and many different communities all together. To have the Cox House represent the presence of the Jewish Historical Society with a shingle so that many people will learn of its presence where they hadn't been when it was not as accessible in the basement. Not only does this give it a place proximate to the research, but it establishes almost a regular presence for any Wilmingtonian, any Delawarean to understand, aha, the Jewish community was essential to the development of Wilmington and Delaware.
You had talked earlier about trying to activate these buildings, but it also, it kind of feels like this is a project that falls in line with this kind of overarching idea that the Historical Society has been working on. Yeah, that includes, as you mentioned, the Mitchell Center for African American Heritage, the renovation of the old town hall, that it's, maybe not only just activating these buildings, but also creating this, we're kind of alluding to, kind of a hub here, a historical hub right here on Market Street.
That's right. In Wilmington, with Commercial Market Street, doesn't have many green spaces. Willingtown Square is one. People come here and just have their lunch, or there's noontime concerts in the summer. So the hub is the idea, and these are all historical buildings. We're seeing some work being done on the research library currently. That's a 1930 adapted bank. Old Town Hall is a 1798 adapted municipal building. We are in the Delaware History Museum and adapted Woolworths. So adaptation is the name of the game. Buildings adapt for different needs. We adapt our kitchens and our bathrooms and our own homes. And historical preservation is the responsible management of change. It adapts. It adapts to the current needs. And it's really the name of the game in our business is how do we make things adapt to a more relevant use for the community as they see it today.
Is there a timetable for this fundraising effort and ultimately the work getting done?
We see a beginning for the work in the spring. And with any luck, we will have an inauguration and opening later in 2020. But right now, we've launched the campaign. It's well on its way to its goals. We've been working with the architects and the leaders of the Jewish Historical Society and the Jewish Federation. We're very excited about this. We have 100% commitment from board members of the Jewish Historical Society and a lot of groundswell of support because people see it as a good idea.
And finally, how can the public get involved in helping this effort?
The public can make their donations and contributions to the Jewish Historical Society. They should check out coxhouse.org, coxehouse.org, to learn a little bit more about the campaign and ways that they can join.
Thanks to the Delaware Historical Society's Executive Director, David Young, for enlightening us this week. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.